Good evening, and welcome to this evening's program hosted by VivaFest and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Marcella Davison-Aviles, and it is really an honor and a distinct pleasure to introduce Deborah Rodriguez, author of Margarita Wednesdays, Making a New Life by the Mexican Sea. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Deborah. At the tender age of 15, she followed in her mother's footsteps and went to beauty school with the idea that she would put herself through college by doing hair. She worked in her mother's salon in Michigan and started taking vacations with a purpose. In 2002, she did just that. Deborah left for Afghanistan with the Care for All Foundation to help administer emergency and disaster relief after the fall of the Taliban. And while she was there, she became involved in the creation of a beauty school training program to help Afghan women set up their own beauty parlors and have a chance at financial independence. Deborah spent 5 years working and then directing the Kabul Beauty School, and later she opened a coffee shop in Kabul. And these experiences led her to two best-selling books, Afghanistan, The Little Coffee Shop in Kabul, and The Kabul Beauty School. Deborah was forced to flee Afghanistan in 2007 and now lives in Mazatlan, Mexico, where she is the owner of Tippy Toes Salon and the Marrakesh Spa. She also established Project Mariposa, which is an organization providing funding for young women to attend beauty school with the goal of becoming independent and self-supporting. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Deborah Rodriguez. And I just loved your book.
Thank you.
And I have to say, from the very, almost the very first page, and I marked it, and I want to read a quote here because it just touched my heart so much. Since my family is from Mexico, I thought this was spot on. You open your book with a quote, "He upon whose heart the dust of Mexico has lain will find no peace in any other land."
Absolutely true.
That is such a beautiful sentiment. I want to ask you, where did you find that?
I was in I was down south in Mexico in Manzanillo, mm-hmm. and I was trying to find something that captured my heart so that I could, you know, like that special quote. In my other books, I've had Rumi quotes, and then a man said, "This is unknown," and he said, "But this has really captured my feeling about Mexico," which it almost does for everybody who goes mm-hmm. down there. Mm-hmm. And I thought, absolutely. And so I thought, that's it. You know, it's the ta-da moment.
Well, it seems like you were able to find south of the border the healing that this sentiment not only implies, but evokes, having come from such a tumultuous experience in Afghanistan. Did you sense that when you first got there, or was that a journey that took a little bit of time?
You know, it was before I went to Mazatlan. I was actually in Napa, and I loved California, but I was really struggling, but because I had PTSD and I had just left Afghanistan and everything was rocky for me. And I was older, mm-hmm. and so therefore I was considered an old hairdresser, which was really a tough gig for me. And I was struggling with that. But when I just couldn't get my footing here for some reason. And I think it was just because I had sticker shock was one reason when going from Afghanistan to Napa. And I think I missed some chaos. And I wasn't in Mexico for more than, a moment. And I thought, I can do this. Mm-hmm. It's like I love the sounds. I didn't know what they were saying. And I think that there was a part of that like started to feed my soul, right? It's like donut, and I'm thinking, okay, I think that guy's selling donuts. It's like, I like that. It's like somebody wanted to shine my shoes. I'm thinking, okay, we have flip-flops on. Everybody has flip-flops on. And so I really like that. And so although I was pretty broken when I got there, the car wash guy, every day I saw the car wash guy, and he used his three words of English. And I used my, you know, hola, my, you know, one word of Spanish. And I felt that friendliness. It was just this really amazing. Everybody seemed to be happy. Of course, I didn't understand what anybody was saying. So, but I did. It fed my soul, truly fed my soul from the very moment I got there.
I have to say that one of the things that would so impress me, not only with, reading your book, but just sort of thinking about your journey, was that the courage that it takes to embark on the adventures that you have, and that which it seems to me requires not only grit, but just curiosity and a real spirit. And I'm wondering if you found in your experience in Afghanistan and your current experience in Mexico a commonality which has caused you to sort of be able to communicate with folks, notwithstanding that you don't know the language, because you see that humanity in people. And I just, you know, I got that from your book so much.
You know, I think that I think sometimes when I was put into a new environment, but all the foreigners that were there, they were also, it's an expat community. There's something kind of special about expat communities. So we had that. So I had that in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. So there was all of a sudden you're in a big town and it gets smaller because now you are a foreigner in this bigger town. And then I lived in Central Historical, which even made it smaller. And so all of a sudden the big town isn't so big. And there's something pretty special, I think, about expatriate communities. And then you get the common things that we all had in common. Like we had sewer problems. We all had sewer problems. Mm-hmm. It rained and all our electricity went off. So everybody was, I think what was really kind of interesting is it didn't matter how much money anybody had. That was not the Mexicans didn't care, nor did they know, nor did they ask. The foreigners, the gringos that were there, they left their big houses or no houses or little cars or big cars north of the border. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was on a level playing field, which really was nice. I think that was, it didn't matter. Nobody cared. And so it was a freedom, I think, more than anything. And I found how the Mexicans embraced family. I loved how they embraced their family. It was all about the family. And I think that was something that I had in Afghanistan. My girls that were my students, they were all about the family. They lived with their mother-in-law and father-in-law, and they lived with family. And so I missed that. I felt a loneliness because my family was in Michigan. And my mom was suffering from dementia. Mm-hmm. And so I missed the family thing. And so when I went to Mexico, I instantly was embedded in the family again. And I love that.
Yeah, I can see how that would be the case. That is a very, almost a central component of Mexican culture.
It's like the most important, yeah. I think. It's all about family. Mm-hmm. It's like my mother has just come to Mexico and is now living with me there. She doesn't know she's in Mexico. She has dementia, and all she knows is she has a chihuahua and she has her family, and we drag her to, I mean, it doesn't matter if we're going to the mall, everybody goes to the mall. If we go out to dancing in the park, everybody goes. Right. So she's never alone. And I think that as the healing for me, this beautiful culture, and she doesn't understand anything. And, mm-hmm. you know, she doesn't understand the language. She has no Spanish. She goes, she'll look at me, she'll say it. I'm so glad I don't know what they're saying. I says, don't worry. Me too. So yeah, so it's, there is something really, really therapeutic. I wish that I could bottle it, because it would be worth millions, because it was something, a healing, magical place for me.
Well, I think you did manage to bottle it in your book.
Yeah, I hope that that's what comes across as the magic of Mexico for me.
Well, it does. And also your the sort of the celebratory astonishment almost at rediscovering your connectedness to family. Mm-hmm. You know, the Dia de los Muertos chapter just tore me up. I mean, it was just really a wonderful depiction, A, of that celebration and heritage, but then the conversation with your father was just, you know, very evocative and very, very meaningful. And, you know, to have the courage to sit down and write that, you know, where did you find that? I mean, here you know, your profession is you're, you know, you run a salon, you're a hairdresser, but you're an award-winning writer. I mean, it's pretty cool.
Well, I think sometimes I have to get it out of my head, because it's whirling 24 hours, mm-hmm. right? And I thought that this is also, it was my journey, right? Mm-hmm. But it could be almost anybody's journey. It could be anybody who has lost a loved one or gone through divorce, or they've had to rebuild their life somehow. It's about rebuilding and somehow finding that place. I always said that my head was too loud for me to even hear my inner voice directing me where I should be going. And I thought once I got to Mexico, somehow there was a peace there that allowed that. And I felt that it was worth sharing, because I thought that this was a really tough journey for me, mm-hmm. going from fleeing from Afghanistan 10 minutes to pack my stuff and I'm out, and to not, it was like, I understood what refugees must feel like. I understand what somebody possibly losing their house in a fire, a flood, that dramatic departure. And that was really, really tough. And I was post-traumatic stress. We mm-hmm. have so many of our military mm-hmm. and people, the aid workers coming back from these areas. And it was so difficult, but yet I felt like I have a happy ending, and I thought that that needed to be told, just if mm-hmm. nothing else, the encouragement for others. And I really wanted to celebrate Mexico and the Mexicans and how much that culture really embraced me and I believe saved my life.
Mm-hmm. Do you find in recalling these memories and taking yourself on that journey again, as a writer, talk about, you know, that discipline. Do you write every day? Did you journal? Did you say, I'm going to go do a sabbatical and just get this all out? Or
no, between haircuts. No, I would get something in my head and I would type it out, and or I would talk into a tape recorder. Mm-hmm. I would have that that key phrase. And I also worked with a very talented woman, Ellen Kay, mm-hmm. who would kind of help me channel mm-hmm. some of it's one thing to, it's really tough when you're poking into your own demons, so to speak. That's a tough gig. And sometimes it took somebody else and other people. It took quite a few people. My friend Karen in the back. I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations we had on the phone trying mm-hmm. to draw out my demons. You know, it was tough. It was hard because this is a very, very personal mm-hmm. book. And, you know, I had to face some really personal things. And I thought if I became raw, I mean, there's nothing that attractive about somebody telling their personal story if it's all shiny, right? I mean, you want grit. You want raw. You want to feel happy when they're happy. You want to cry when they cry. And you want to think, what was she thinking? You know, so you want all these emotions. And that's tough. That's hard.
You've had a unique opportunity to, as someone who's a smart businesswoman, adventuresome traveler, to incubate small business, enterprise, empowerment projects, you know, in very disparate places, Afghanistan and Mexico, to be working with young women. Did you find elements that these young women had in common? Did you find major differences? You yourself as a businesswoman and entrepreneur?
You know what? First of all, hairdressing is pretty much hairdressing across the board. It's, you know, a beauty shop is a beauty shop anywhere in the world. So, I mean, that is like an even playing field. And then you have women, and basically we're all the same. I mean, in one way or another, when you get down to the grit, we all want the same things. The hairdressing, I have found some cultural things that mm-hmm. are very different. Obviously, my girls in Mexico will come to work in very, very short shorts. And my girls in Kabul came, you know, burqa. So, I mean, there was some big differences there. But it was, it's, you know, it's a beauty shop, and it draws the same sort of people, right? You usually have to actually like people mm-hmm. to want to be in that profession. So, I would have my hair done, and I'd be sitting in the beauty shop in Mexico, and I would listen and I would hear Spanish, right? But it brought me back to my days in Afghanistan, and it really made me feel homesick. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, I can do this. And I thought, oh, I don't want to do this. You know, as soon as you do it, it's a lot of work. And so, but they're very similar, but very different, right? It's just the two cultures, but it's just doing business in a different culture. So
did you find, I'm very interested to hear about, you know, doing a startup, if you will, in Afghanistan in terms of the actual risk to do that, both to the women that you were helping and to yourself. I mean, 'cause it's, you know, based on what I've read and heard on the radio and on broadcast accounts, that you know, for women to empower themselves that way is, you know, you could risk your life doing it.
Right. Well, you know what? The one thing I've read, things like, she brought in to Afghanistan like a foreign sort of idea, mm-hmm. right? Well, which hairdressing was not. They're much bigger with the hair and makeup than what we would ever even think about being. And that was, again, another thing very, very common, something very similar with the Mexican culture too, mm-hmm. is the wedding hair, my girls all go get their makeup done right before, you know, going anywhere yeah. for any event. And so that was something that was very similar. But any time that you're dealing back in the day, so we're talking 2002, 3 to say 5 in Afghanistan, those were a bit easier days for NGOs and bringing new things to the table, such as doing the beauty school, having the salon. Things changed drastically. We could start seeing the decline of things after the riots in 2005 was a real pivotal moment for a lot of us as foreigners living there. It's like there was quite some hostility brewing that we were very naive about. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that now things may be a lot different as far as the risk factor. But we did one thing that was really important when we would do an interview, like they would be, 200 women that showed up at the school to be, wanted to be a part of the schooling. And the big thing that we had to do was make sure that the male elder in their family was okay with them. Without that permission, bucking that tide was not acceptable. And it would have been it would have caused a lot of problems. We had to stay within the cultural, things that were okay. And so that was very important that we always had kind of almost like a release form saying, does your husband, father, older brother, are they okay with you coming to the beauty school? And so.
Wow. Well, we've got some questions here, so I do want to get to those. The first one is, what exactly was it that forced you out of Afghanistan? How did you end up in Mazatlan rather than another place in Mexico?
Okay, so it was right after my book tour in 2007 for the Kabul Beauty School. Prior to leaving for my tour, I think that everybody is familiar with the word chatter. You hear it on, we've heard chatter. There had been chatter, and you never know where that's coming from. You don't know who's chattering. That there was a possible risk factor for myself. And after I got back, there were about three sources, three different days that began to tell me that you're in danger, that your presence could cause danger to anybody around you. That meant my school, my salon, and the coffee house, and anybody who was near me, which, again, you don't know if this is true, if this is not true. It's chatter. And so then I kept hearing, I heard somebody called me. A lot of things were going, kind of happening all at the same time. It was a very, very, very fast. It happened very quickly. But I got a phone call, and I was told from a security company who monitors the chatter, and we would prescribe as foreigners or NGOs, we would subscribe to their emails, and they would then post us on, don't go on this road, don't eat at this restaurant, don't go to this hotel on these days, because we've heard. And they told me that there is a plot to kidnap your son. And they basically gave me 10 minutes to make a decision. And they said, if you do not leave within this time frame, we will not help you get out of the country. And so it was at that point, I very quickly gathered my stuff and my son, and they got me. I literally ran with my suitcase to the safe house that they knew was close to where I lived, and or not to the safe house, to a restaurant actually, and they closed the restaurant down as soon as I got in there, and then took the next 24 hours and got me out of the country, and then I landed in San Francisco. So it was you know what, it was really frightening.
Yeah, this next question is basically asking about that, but also asks, you know, out of that experience, how did you know you were a writer, or when did you know you were a writer?
When did I know that I was a writer? I think that I've always, wrote. I journaled all my life, and I kept emails. I mean, I would write just these. I was one of those people that you did not want on your email list because I wrote these really, really, really long emails telling everybody what just, you know, the exciting things that just happened or the scary things. So when I was in Afghanistan, I had, by the time I wrote the Kabul Beauty School, I had 500 pages of stories. So I think that I've always been, I'm a storyteller, yeah, probably first and foremost. Writing was always kind of a byproduct of the storytelling. My family's from the South, long history of storytelling. So, and I'm a hairdresser. That's what we do. So
the next question here is, who in your life encouraged you
to write, or
spurred, well, this question spurred you on, I guess, spurred you on in life, or
my mom. Mm-hmm. My mom was my best friend. I worked with her all my life in the salon, and I wrote in the book that my mother always told me that I could be anything I wanted to be. I said, well, I want to be a princess. Well, she says, well, you can do that. And I says, well, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that. She goes, you can be all of that. She always encouraged me to, she never gave me the feeling that it wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. That if you want to be a princess, go ahead, you know, be a princess. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, we'll give that a whirl, yeah, you know. So yeah, my mom always let me, I never realized that things weren't possible. And so, I mean, I didn't even think that it wasn't possible to do a beauty school in Afghanistan. I just thought, well, I guess we'll just, you know, we'll do a beauty school in Afghanistan.
Right.
Seems easy enough. Yeah.
You've been in Mexico now for a little bit of time, and there's been, it seems to me, especially since the recent presidential elections, that there's been some positive change there economically, with the growth in various sectors, technology and what have you. Are you seeing a change in the environment? How do you feel life is for American citizens in Mexico?
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, it's easy, it's fun, it's a tight-knit community. I mean, it's for me, it's paradise. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know so many, it's economically easier to live. A lot of people in Mazatlan are on fixed incomes, mm-hmm, and they can live a very high lifestyle. And also, this is all putting money back into the economy and for Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice. It's people, you know, there was a lot of negative press about how unsafe it is. I have never experienced a moment of not safe. I have never, I have always had good medical care and health care, and I honestly have absolutely nothing negative to say about Mexico. It's been a really positive moment. Everything has been good for me. I have issues sometimes just because I get frustrated because, you know, there's sewer bubbling up in the middle of the street, right? I get frustrated when, you know, my pipes are 700 years old and, you know, I have sewer bubbling up in my closet. So, you know, we have these issues. But those are quirky things, and it adds character, you know, to the place. I do say that sometimes it takes a little bit more work and a little bit more persistence for, say, a business owner. I'm running a business mm-hmm. without the language, mm-hmm. which is really tricky. And I always say that I was prepped for it quite well mm-hmm. with running a business in Afghanistan. So when people are complaining, oh, this is so hard and blah, 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 I'm thinking, really, it's not compared to. So it's easier mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, you know what? I feel like it's almost like paradise there. And if it were so simple, then everybody would be there. So we do have a little bit of bumps and bruises along the way. But I think that's with any business anywhere in the world. Open up a new business here. You're going to still have your little bumps and learning curves. I mean, I really wish that I had a grasp on the language. This is my biggest downfall, mm-hmm. not because I need it there, because I don't. I mean, there's enough English speakers there, and the wonderful Mexicans tolerate my Spanglish, right? But every time I try to learn Spanish and I just get ready to say something fast, Farsi comes out. So I've just had the worst time getting rid of one language because right. it seemed like my head cannot hold the two of them. So I'm slowly, slowly working on that. I think that would make my life a bit easier if I did have a grasp on the language.
Well, I think it's terrific to hear you say that about your experience because it is... It does contradict a lot of what folks, you know, read in the papers about the state of life down in Mexico, and between folks that I know, such as yourself, who live down there, or members of my own family. Right. I mean, what I'm hearing is the exact opposite.
Right.
And I think that it's just such a shame that the mainstream media has a one-sided perspective on life south of the border.
Right. I mean, and Mazatlan lost their cruise ships, and that was devastating, devastating for the town. I mean, we recovered, and the cruise ships are coming back, but it's a working city, so it mm-hmm. was not tourist. Its economy isn't based on the tourism, but we would be watching the news, and it would have all this negative stuff about Mexico, and we're thinking, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Serious? As we're like doing a shot of tequila and, you know, dancing in the street, feeling not a threat at all. Right. I mean, trust me, there's been a lot of talk down south mm-hmm. about how frustrated we are
right.
about it, because it affects so many people. I mean, just the cruise ships. I mean, how many millions of people stopped going to Mazatlan? How many taxi drivers then now don't have business? I mean, there are businesses that just were shuttered
right.
because of it. I mean, it really trickled down to, I didn't start my business until the very worst of it. So like the cruise ships had already gone. It was like cruise ships, swine flu, and the economy. Right. I mean, there couldn't have been a better time to start a business, right? And so because of my wise business savvy, and so I did, I thought, well, it can't get worse. And, you know.
My family comes from the border, from the Arizona border, and it was the exact same phenomenon of, here's a bustling border town, very busy on both sides of the line, and then just as if someone had turned off a light, you know, it's just a ghost town.
Right.
And in terms of the impact to the economy. This question is a very good one. At what point in your journey did you feel that you were on your way to healing from your PTSD?
I would have to say in that last chapter with the Day of the Dead, I don't know. I'm certain that you've all heard of the Day of the Dead, right? I had heard of it too, but I didn't really understand it. And I was kind of said I wanted to go, but yet I didn't really understand it. And I was in Afghanistan when my father died, and I really felt drawn to this small little town, Pátzcuaro. They have a big Day of the Dead celebration with the Puepecha Indians. So there's different traditional areas. And I had always heard how beautiful it was. So I was going there, you know, kind of like you would go to see any celebration. But they kept saying to me, it's magical. It's going to be magical. I'm thinking, okay. And then they said, you never know what's going to happen on the night of the dead. And I'm thinking, okay. And Cynthia, who's in the book, who happened to be a trauma therapist, specialist, which was just kind of a miracle in itself.
Right.
I landed in her B&B. And she said to me, you need to make a shrine to your father. And I'm thinking, really? Well, why? And he says, well, because you need to have a conversation with him. I think it's a really healing thing. I've heard you talking all kinds of stuff about your mother, your mom this, your mom that. I never hear you talking about your dad. I says, well, you know, it was a complicated relationship. And, you know, he died when I was in Afghanistan. She says, you need to tell him everything you've done. And they said that the veil is thin on that night of the dead. And so she helped me set the whole thing up. Water for when they come mm-hmm. over the border, so to speak, mm-hmm. because they're thirsty. The candle so that they can see, because if you don't have a candle there, they have to light their finger. The marigolds and
right.
the sugar skulls. And so it was this amazing time for me to remember my dad. So it was just a whole day of, oh, I remember he liked this kind of beer. Oh, let's get him this kind of beer. Oh, he loves chocolate cake. So we got him chocolate cake. All this beautiful stuff that my dad, it was a celebration for my father. And I sat there after going to the graveyards, which of course I thought was going to be creepy. I sat with so many families drinking little teeny cups of, I don't know what it was, but I drank it anyways. And they had food laid out and there was a party and there was music and this huge, beautiful celebration. It was the most amazing time in my life. And they, after that celebration, I mean, it was as if the light switched on for me. It was as if the magic of that area just impacted into my life. And I knew that I'd turn the corner. And, but it was, and having the conversation with my father, and I really felt there was something in the air. I mean, you could almost, like if it had been a movie, right? The candle flickering and all that. You could feel it. You could feel something in the air.
I could feel that just from reading it.
Yeah,
you know,
it was amazing.
The way you share that conversation with your dad was It was almost like my own dad was suddenly in the room. I mean, it was so compelling.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was a time for me to tell him about the grandbabies. Mm-hmm. My son has married a Mexican woman. I have my grandbabies are there. And so I have, you know, I have a little grandbaby that speaks both Spanish and English. And, you know, she's mixing the two up. And I could tell him about my life in Afghanistan, about my life in Mexico. And it was, and I do that now. We make this a priority in my salon, actually, that anybody who has passed, we always do a shrine mm-hmm. for them, because I didn't understand it, right? And so I thought, oh, that's kind of, you know, it seemed creepy a little bit, because it was about dead, but it's not. It's a celebration of life. It's a time for the family to remember and just relish. And I bought my dad Fruit Loops and put it in his shrine because he loves Fruit Loops, right? And so it was just all that sort of favorite stuff. I love it. I love that it's my most favorite time of the year.
Yeah, that whole activity of putting together an altar, putting together the shrine itself, just the action of doing that, and each element, you know, those recollections by themselves are just so healing. I've had friends tell me who are not from the Latino community that they've embraced Dia de los Muertos for that very reason, because they were really needing to heal over a loved one passing, and they just found that the path to healing was in recalling what was so special about that person.
Right, and then and sitting around and telling the stories. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is. It's a beautiful, beautiful time.
Well, our next question is also about inspiration. What inspired you to start going on vacations with a purpose and giving back to the community?
You know, I think that this was something like I was always that way from a small child. And I wanted to be able to go to Jamaica or, you know, someplace, but it was not, I could not somehow justify it completely, as in, you know, spending that amount of money maybe just on myself. And so I would think, okay, so I'm going to do 6 days in the resort and 1 day someplace else in an orphanage, or I'm going to raise some money and give it to these people. Or often I would find young women who had babies and I would get them diapers. I would just try to make just a small impact, you know, just giving back just a little bit. And so that started my vacation with a purpose. Mm-hmm. And then it was an amazing way to see the different cultures and the world and give back and not have it be just all about me. Mm-hmm. And it was my way of rewarding myself. I love people, and I think I'm not a real resort person, and so I like to be out on the outskirts to see the real areas. And so,
do you think that call to service was something that you got from your mom and dad?
You know, my mom and dad never quite knew where that came from. But I always had it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was trying to save something from, like, you know, I think when I was in fourth grade, I chained myself to a tree. So it was just always there. So,
and how are you finding now that, you know, you've got this done, three books, my goodness, what's next?
Well, right now I'm working on my fourth book. So,
yeah.
And so, I mean, I love the storytelling mm-hmm. aspect. I really love that. I'm going back to Mazatlan. I have to work on the school and the girls. I've got a bunch of students, so.
So more stories from Mexico, you think?
This next one, the one that I'm working on now that I don't have titled at all, it's actually going to be part two to the little coffee shop.
Okay.
And it's going to take place, two stories running parallel, one in Afghanistan and one actually in a winery. So it's a kind of an odd combination, but we're moving our characters. We're doing a new voice of the young people now existing in Afghanistan, and what does this look like for Afghans, doing it on their own terms and without the foreigners there, as in, you know, running their country going forward. What does that look like?
What do you see for that region in terms of, you know, the future?
That's a really, really complicated question.
Yeah,
and I just,
of course.
I follow everything constantly. I'm still obsessed. I think it's going to be the youth. I really feel that it's going to be the 20-somethings now that have, you know, they're tired. They're tired of war. They're tired of the drug lords and the warlords, and they're tired of the corruption. And I believe that it'll be their voice that will change the future of Afghanistan. I think they'll be taking charge of their own country.
Do you feel that technology and the ability to communicate has really been a catalyst for that empowerment?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. I think it's, you know, I mean, when I first got there, there was no cell phones, satellite phones. There was no internet. And that was, what, 2002? There was no communication. I mean, so now they have TV and, you know, internet. I mean, everything that we have, they have. It's just in different levels of it.
Do you ever see yourself going back?
Not anytime soon, just because it's, again, still complicated for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you travel much in Mexico?
I do. I drive
everywhere. Go shopping?
I do. I do. I go shopping. I drive everywhere. I love road trips in Mexico. It's just amazing. And so
I noticed that in the book.
I do.
It seems like at the drop of the hat, it's like road trip.
Road trip. Exactly. I'm all about the road trip.
Where would you make a recommendation for someone to, you know, rather than say to go to the usual places? Are there
obviously Mazatlan if you're looking for a beach town, right? And it's because it's
to get your hair done.
Oh, get your hair done, mani pedis, absolutely, or see my grandchildren. And but you know what? Putzcoatl for the Day of the Dead. Absolutely.
Now, where is that exactly?
It's in the state of Michoacán.
Okay.
And it's, oh, goodness. I'd have to, like, it's over there, right?
I looked it up before coming here, and it just seems like it's a
beautiful... It's by Morelia.
Yeah.
It's near Morelia. It's only about a nine-hour drive from Mazatlan.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a pretty easy jaunt to from Mexico City. Oaxaca. Oaxaca is really quite cultural, very indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Putzcoatl is very indigenous. I have Chiapas. I have not been to Chiapas. That is my next place on the radar, is I must go down to Chiapas. Mexico is so rich.
Yeah.
So rich. I have never seen... I've traveled everywhere. I mean, I love traveling. And now I can't get enough of it. It's like you can get, I just came back from Mexico City not that long ago. Oh, amazing, amazing. The culture, the sophistication. I mean, I think the Mexicans are not on burros. Right. It is.
They're not wearing sombreros. And
yeah. No.
In the garden.
Not and leaning against the cactus or something. No. It's a very sophisticated country. It's stunning. It's the language, the the different areas and the...
Well, it's very diverse.
Oh, my goodness. And then we now have the tallest bridge.
Right.
Right? I drove over that. That is something definitely to see, the road to Durango. You know, John Wayne made his movies there. And so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that the wonderful thing about Mexico in terms of discovering, you know, its people and the country is really encountering that amazing diversity that exists there. I think people do feel like or have a one-dimensional view of the country and the influence from Africa, from Asia, from Europe, the indigenous, the many indigenous communities and languages. It's an amazing mélange of just beauty and history and culture.
Well, I was really, I found quite interesting. My insurance guy is named Juan Chong. And I thought, well, that's kind of funny. And mm-hmm. there's this huge, the Chinese.
Yeah.
Huge. Okay, so the Germans came to Mazatlan and taught them how to make beer. So there's a huge German population.
Yep.
The Mennonites are there.
Yep.
It's so diverse. It's so diverse.
And I think that that is, you know, the more that those various threads of that narrative can come out and be told, and that is what I think your book did so well, is to really present through your own personal journey, a portrait of another country that not a lot of people, you know, have a chance to see. And I was really drawn to it. And, you know, I think that it's another great way for people to become not only more acquainted with Mexico, but comfortable to kind of get within its skin. And I think it seemed like that's what you were doing in telling this story, is to sort of reclaim your own skin, so to speak,
right.
and heal.
And it was, Mexico was forgiving to me. Mm, they
wow.
were, yeah, it was forgiving for my craziness at the time, right? I didn't feel, I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. I was having all my issues with just trying to figure out who I was. And, you know, it didn't matter. That's what was really nice. I didn't feel like I was, it was okay for me not to be okay. And,
you know, that quality that you just talked about is something, if you were to read A Labyrinth of Solitude by Octavio Paz, and there's a couple of chapters and essays there in which he talks about the Mexican custom of going to festivals and having festivals, and how, you know, folks will spend a lot of money on the celebratory effort when it can, you know, why are you spending so much money to come together as a community and celebrate, you know, who you are? Don't you need to feed your kids? And really what he was saying and what you are saying is that that's not the point. The point is, in doing that, you're reclaiming yourself. You're reclaiming your identity. You're finding your own heart.
Right. And it's all about the fiesta. It is
That's
fun.
Right.
You know, it is. It's amazing. I think that I would love to... Well, I really love it if people will read the book and find the love. You know, I fell in love with Mexico. It became an affair that I began.
I think there's a long tradition of folks going there and kind of going native.
Right. I mean, I don't have my flip-flops on today. But yeah, I mean, I've always was one of the kind of person who always dressed up and always had, you know, like always nice clothing on. And I find myself like in like T-shirts and, you know, flip-flops, and I've gone so casual. I've gone so native, basically. And it's like, because it's okay. Mm-hmm. I can not wear makeup, and it's okay.
And you brought your family with you.
I did. Well, not on purpose.
Right.
I mean,
well, they ended up coming on the journey with
yes,
you.
Yes, they did. And you know what? I have to tell you this one little funny story was my mother has dementia, and we removed her from her home, and now she's in Mexico with me, which is kind of funny in itself. So the only so they're cleaning her house up. This all just happened. So there's people in her home now
Michigan
in cleaning her home out, right? And my aunt calls me. She said, we found, my father's name was Junior. They called him June. We found June. I'm like, oh, you found pictures of Dad. Oh, that's fabulous. They go, no, we found June. I go, really? Yeah, he's in the closet. I'm like, okay. So Mom had stashed Dad, his ashes, in the closet. We all thought he was, like, buried. And so Dad is coming to Mexico, too. So we'll be a completely, other than if my, I would love to have my son Zachary in Mexico too, but he is now working in D.C., so.
And you have grandchildren who are bilingual and binational and,
yep.
and perhaps they will
absolutely
teach you Spanish.
Yes, yes, yes. I have learned, I'm learning to sing Frozen in Spanish and in English. So.
Well, I think that, you know, we're getting close to the end of our conversation here. And I think I'll give myself sort of the last question. And that is that, and I'm, you know, perhaps you get asked this question a lot, given your success as a writer, but it, you know, would you do it again?
This journey?
The journey to Afghanistan.
Oh, you know, Afghanistan was 9/11 was probably the most pivotal moment in my life and changed the course of history for pretty much everybody.
Right.
And it also really changed the course of history for my life. And Afghanistan opened my eyes up to something that I never quite knew about myself. I always I hate to say the word, not appreciated the hairdresser in me. And I realized that who I am as a human being and my gift, my talent as a hairdresser can go a long ways in embracing who you are and not trying to be who you aren't. And so it was a real, a real journey. It really has been, on multiple levels. And I think that if I had to do it over again, there would be a few things I might tweak out. I think we all would in our lives. And probably leave a husband or so out of that one. Yeah, I could have maybe eliminated one or so.
Well, you know, in reading your book, it caused me to realize and to think that really, you know, what does a hairdresser do but be in service to their client to create this transformation and to then send them out, you know, with that confidence, and you do that every day while you're telling the story.
Right.
And so just kind of in thinking of that being your chosen profession, it just seems to be make a lot of sense that you found a way
right
to do that in
right.
Afghanistan. You found a way to do that in Mexico, and you continue to.
And I don't think I'm your typical writer as far as I do believe myself as a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found a way to communicate in, you know, my storytelling and more, you know, the a bigger venue than, you know, gathering around the fire. And so
and to leave people with something not only to think about but to be inspired by. And I think that's a really great way to end this evening. I want to thank you so much for, you know, having your journey come here to the San Francisco Bay Area and to share your story with us. And I want to thank everyone here for being here. And on that note, I'm going to go ahead and conclude this meeting of the Commonwealth Club. And Deborah, thank you so much. It's just been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much.